You are listening to the INCJ podcast, Conversations about International Criminal Justice.
Right, well, good afternoon, everyone, and a very warm welcome to the International Network for Criminal Justice seminar. This seminar follows on from a presentation and a short discussion that took place on the 7th of May, when we heard a wonderful presentation by Fergus McNeill, who was and is leading a major five-year study funded by the European Research Council's Advanced Grant Scheme on the topic of rehabilitation and reintegration in Europe, working with colleagues in the universities of Leiden, Miranda Boone and Hilde Werning, and in Oslo. We will all of us taken something from that seminar, and I'm not from Fergus's presentation, and I'm not going to try to summarize a very rich and thought-provoking presentation, but three things that I particularly took away from this. First of all, Fergus offered us conceptions of rehabilitation that were much broader and deeper than the usual understanding of psychological correctionalism, which dominates the discussions of rehabilitation in many countries. Secondly, Fergus underscored the value of international comparison. This is much more than penological tourism, although that's of interest anyway. Not least in, but it's a particular value, I think, of showing what our respective countries may be at risk of taking for granted just because it's so familiar to us and becomes a stimulus. That reflection becomes a stimulus to better practice. And thirdly, the research methods, the development of the research methods I found particularly striking, which model best practice in supporting resistance with an emphasis on ideas of alliance and co-creation. I hope that doesn't do too much violence to your presentation, Fergus. Those for me were the three most important things, but others, of course, will have gained their own ideas and thoughts from it. We begin the seminar with a presentation from Professor Thomas Ugelvik, who's a professor at the University of Oslo. Thomas isn't able to join us, and shortly after I've introduced him, Rob is going to play for us a recording of a presentation. Thomas is a scholar of penology, including the practical execution of punishment, the subjective experience of it, and the after effects. And his research projects have included a study of prison release and re-entry into society in Norway, and a prison health project, which studied healthcare service delivery in prison, and the idea that prisons can be healthy institutions. He's written a book entitled Power and Resistance in Prison, Doing Time, Doing Freedom. I knew him personally when he worked with a journal, which some of you may remember, called Eurovista, although that journal no longer continues. But when it did, he was a reviewer for us and he championed the cause. I think I'll just also indulge myself by telling you that that Thomas's may have come up with one of the finest titles of any academic paper I've ever come across. And this was entitled Three Burglars, A Friendly Police Inspector, and A Vegetarian Fox, Scandinavian Exceptionalism, Children's Literature, and Desistance Conducive Cultures. And not only is that a very beguiling title, it happens to be an extremely good paper, so good, in fact, that I'm going to put it in the comments if any of you would like to follow it up. Rob, can I ask you please to play Thomas's recording?
Hello, everybody. My name is Thomas Ugelvik, and I'm a professor of criminology here at the University of Oslo. And I'm also responsible for the Norwegian part of the RARI project. I'm very sorry that I am unable to be part of the conversation, the discussions today live, but I'm happy that at the very least I'm able to contribute some thoughts and reflections through this recording. I've been given two questions. The first is about motivation. What motivated you to join the research project? The second is about possible outcomes. What can each country, Norway in my case, hope to get out of the research project? When it comes to personal motivation, I think the answer is sort of obvious in the sense that who wouldn't want to be part of such a project, fantastically interesting project, with a stellar lineup of great scholars. I think we're all super motivated. So I think it's I have high hopes and ambitions when it comes to how much fun we're going to have over the years to come. So I'm really looking forward to getting started properly. When it comes to question two, what Norway or the Norwegian penal research, criminology research field can hope to get out of the program or the project, sorry. I guess from a Norwegian perspective, I think we have to say that currently we are in sort of quite a good place. I mean, when I started doing research on prisons and punishment more than 20 years ago, we had some classics in the field. We have some, we had some big names. Thomas Mathiesen and Nils Christie were still both active as researchers. And some of their, groundbreaking classic works were obviously very important, but, Thomas's, groundbreaking study, The Defenses of the Weak, for instance, was still very much read and still very much sort of a standard reference, I guess. But the empirical data had been collected back in the 1960s, and the period between the 60s and 70s and when I started just after the millennium change, hadn't seen a lot of empirical studies. So there were some student theses out there, but not a lot. So 20 years later today, we're I would say quite a big and growing group of scholars doing research, empirical research on prisons and prisons, the everyday life in prisons, specific institutions, specific units, how they work, et cetera, et cetera. There's also been a growing number of projects that are empirical, that are comparative, comparing Norway to other countries, et cetera. So I feel we know today quite a lot when it comes to Norwegian prisons and like I said, the everyday life and how these institutions function. We don't know a lot still about the outcomes and about the rehabilitation and re-entry process, sort of following a prison sentence, what happens when people are released and are expected to return back to society. There are a few studies out there, but I would say we know a lot more about prisons than we do about the aftermath and process of reintegration following a prison sentence. So a significant research gap still exists there. I mean, looking at recidivism rates, Norway very often is highlighted as sort of the best example or sort of the best practice, exceptional place where you want to go if you want to study well-functioning prisons, et cetera, et cetera. You all know John Pratt's groundbreaking or seminal work on Scandinavian penal exceptionalism. But again, we have the recidivism rates, and of course, comparing these recidivism rates is notoriously difficult, and there are so many different ways of counting or measuring recidivism, and these numbers are often very hard to compare. But let's just bracket all these well-known headaches for a little while. Let's just agree that last time I checked, the general 2-year recidivism rate in this country was 18% or just below 20%, which is comparatively speaking very, very low. So it seems to be the case that people go to prison here. For some reason, they return to prison much more rarely or much less often than in many other countries. We don't really know why. I mean, several different explanations have been suggested. Going back to Pratt, he suggested a huge sort of culture of equality and the welfare state, et cetera, as explanatory factors. But we haven't really, as a collective of scholars, we haven't really looked properly yet, I would say, at the reintegration process following a prison sentence. We don't know exactly what happens. We don't know exactly why. It seems that we're quite successful at it. Should we look at the prisons themselves, at programs within prisons, at what happens during the prison sentence? Should we look at the society where people are, that people are returned back into, are expected to be part of once they're released? What factors, what aspects should we look at? I mean, it's still very much research terra incognita, and I think that's very exciting, very interesting, and I am looking forward to. I'm sure we will be able to fill in at least some of the blank spaces on this map. So that's my ambition, and that is also what I think Norway and the other countries, I guess, that are part of the RARE project will get out of the project. So, let's see. But that's where I hope and I think we're going. Thanks.
That's usually the cue for the chair to thank someone, isn't it? But I'm not quite sure what the protocol is for thanking a recording. But nevertheless, Thomas has made a fascinating start to our conversation. I'm going to ask Miranda to speak in a moment. Miranda Boone is a professor of criminology and comparative criminology at Leiden University, where she's been since 2017, having earlier worked at universities of Groningen and Utrecht. She conducts research at the interface of criminology and criminal law, with a special focus on sentencing and enforcement. She's been involved in a number of international comparative research projects and has edited a textbook on the relationship between criminology and criminal law, which is now in its third edition. So it's been clearly well received and valued by students and researchers. Her current research work includes projects on decisions following non-compliance with conditions in probation supervision and a 5-year project into differences in detention populations between Belgium and the Netherlands. I am particularly pleased to see Miranda again. In 2014, just a couple of years before my country was tricked by rascals and knaves into Brexit, she came to Leicester to talk about the EU and the effect of the European probation rules on the practices across Europe. And she helped us then to recognize the importance of human rights and the extent to which the European rules sometimes stumbled over those, although it was designed to enhance them. So it's great to see Miranda again. And Miranda, if I may pass to you, the floor, the virtual floor is yours.
Yes, thank you very much for this introduction, Rob. Seems already a long time ago, 2014. And also thank you very much for the invitation. My internet seemed to be a little bit unstable, so if you're not able to understand me, please let me know. But it's very nice to share some of our ideas in this very early stage of the project. But before I start, I want to stress that I'm not the only one working on the Dutch part of the project. Happily, we could also convince my Leiden colleague Hilde Werming to join us when we were working on the proposal. She's a great quantitative researcher, and she will be very much involved in work package 2, in which we will try to make a more quantitative comparison of the types of rehabilitation that exist in the different countries and the scale of it and at what cost. And we were successful in recruiting Ulla Kaumans. Maybe she is also here. Oh, yes, I see her name now on the screen for the PhD project, for the Dutch PhD project. She made a great impression in the application state, and since that time, she is only exceeding our expectations. So we have quite a team already in the Netherlands. And yeah, you also asked me, Rob, to prepare a 10-minute introduction about my motivation and expectations for the project. I'm very glad to do that. Now, first, I will start with what motivated me for the project. I think every project starts with curiosity, and that is not different for this project. I don't think a similar broad, comparative, long-term study to the concepts of rehabilitation and reintegration has been conducted before, so it's very exciting to be part of it. And the curiosity primarily concerns the situation in my own country. Also in the Netherlands, dozens of overwhelming amount of research has been conducted into this topic, not at least by myself and colleagues of our institute, but both the field itself as the study of it are very fragmented. And there's a rather strict division between the different fields of the criminal justice system in which these concepts play a role. Juvenile justice, the criminal justice system for adults, and the forensic field, and many, many subdivisions. So a first valuable output of the project is therefore to get an overview of what we already know about the policies and practices in these different fields, and to do a kind of internal comparison of what we can learn from the different fields, what the different fields can learn from each other. I'm pretty sure, for example, that we use our best technologies and resources for the fields that I am least familiar with, the forensic and juvenile field. And a relevant normative question would be how these differences can be justified, for example. So now we are now in the middle of getting that overview in work package one that I am conducting together with Ella. Most of all, however, my curiosity is triggered by the comparative character of the project, of course. The slogan on the website of the Comparative Criminal Justice Master that I initiated in Leiden together with colleagues years ago is still: only when you learn about other systems, you can start to understand your own. We take actually what we do for granted until we see and understand that other persons or countries do it in a totally different way. But really understanding what is happening in another culture or country is very complicated and also very time consuming. I think after 15 years of doing comparative research, I still only understand what is happening in neighborhood country Belgium. So that brings me to the second question, the expectations I have of the project. And I think the comparative character of the project is also expected to be one of the biggest change makers. The other important component I have high expectations of is the ethnographic character and the focus on lived experience. The combination is still rather rare because rules and numbers can be compared more easily by juxtaposition, but the local practices that we study in more qualitative designs do not necessarily say anything about the culture or the country that we want to reflect on. The culturally embedded character, typical for qualitative and ethnographic research, makes it difficult to draw more general conclusions from its findings, and you need well-developed theory to bridge that gap. So I think it's very important that we have the six forms of rehabilitation model that Furkes developed together with Rubio Arnal, to give us that such a theoretical framework. But I still expect, however, based on my experiences in other comparative research, that at the end of the project, we are not so much comparing countries, but rather models that we will find to a greater or lesser extent in the three countries involved. I was already involved in several comparative studies, smaller ones though, with both Norway and Scotland, and some of my expectations also rise from the results of those studies. To give one example, one of my PhD students, Jill van der Rijt, who's now finishing her comparative dissertation on the meaning of the normalization principle in Norway and the Netherlands. She already published several papers on her results. And when she was doing her field work in Norway a few months ago, I accidentally called her while she was in a shop with some detained persons. That situation that she described to me in more detail in a later stage is already rather unthinkable, actually, for the Netherlands nowadays. Yeah? What strikes me most about her findings so far is that Norwegian policymakers are apparently still able to resist the political and societal pressure to show no form of humanity whatsoever towards incarcerated individuals and people involved in the criminal justice system. It is used to be a strong characteristic of the Netherlands as well in the past, as already was described by David Downs in his Contrasts of Tolerance, published in 1988. And according to this study, the absence of a strong sensation press and the relative autonomy of judges and policymakers of societal pressure was one of the reasons that the Netherlands, compared to England and Wales and other European countries at the time, had a very low prison population. But we seem to have largely lost that skill nowadays, and I'm very curious how Norway has managed to partially retain it. This is one rather detailed example of what kind of expectations I have about the project and about the results of the project. Now, the project will also involve intense research into the experiences of people undergoing rehabilitation. And to be honest, I have the highest expectations for this part of the project because the most innovative insights I have gained in recent years on the functioning of the criminal justice system were the results of conversations I had with experts by experience, as we call them in the Netherlands. A strong element of the project is that we also let these experts speak directly to policymakers and practitioners by bringing them together in creative workshops in which we further develop our dialogical comparative penology. Without knowing anything about the findings of the project yet, I hope that as a result, these experts by experience will be structurally involved in decision-making on rehabilitation and reintegration in all layers of policymakers. And I think the structural dialogue, this structural dialogue could really push decision-making in a totally different direction. Okay, this so far, I think, Rob.
Okay, thank you so much, Miranda. Really instructive and helpful. Thank you. And then, if I may, now turn to Fergus. Now, Fergus McNeill is Professor of Criminology and Social Work at the University of Glasgow. And prior to becoming an academic in the last millennium, Fergus worked for a decade in residential drug rehabilitation as a criminal justice social worker. And he's particularly well known, I think, for showing how increasing knowledge about desistance might reshape rehabilitation and reintegration. And he's used increasingly creative and ethnographic methods to better understand how criminal justice is experienced, both by those who are subject to it and by those whose job it is to try to realize it in practice. And I think I said last time, Fergus, and at the risk of making you blush, his prize-winning book, Pervasive Punishment, Making Sense of Mass Supervision, is a great read. Sorry about that. I nearly said something insulting. It's not at all intended. I couldn't decide whether to say super or great, so I came up with something different. Fergus, I'm sorry about that. Welcome, and please now present to us.
Thanks, Rob. Yeah, I'll try to keep this relatively brief because I obviously had plenty of time to speak to people last time out. But I'll address the same two questions as Thomas and Miranda. So the first question is a question of the motivation for the project. Why develop this proposal and why pursue this this project for 5 years? The honest answer is that I was in the very fortunate position a couple of years ago of having a 6 month study leave, and I knew it would be the last one for a while, and I was thinking about how much of my academic career remained, beginning to sort of project myself towards retirement, but thinking across the length of a career about trying to imagine a summative or a synoptic contribution, something that pulled lots of different threads together. And I settled on rehabilitation because it has been a lifelong interest, and I mean literally lifelong. So religion and politics were part of my upbringing, and they led me into studying initially philosophy, politics and history, with a bit of a side interest in theology too. So in very broad terms, through all those disciplines, I've been interested in ideas and ideals of the good life, the good person, the good state. And I've also always been troubled by and interested in questions of repair, questions of redemption, to use a theological concept, or return, re-entry, recovery, and hence rehabilitation. So what do we do as humans, individually and collectively, when things go wrong, when we do harm to one another? I mean, that interest kind of took deeper root when I began my career after graduating. My first job, proper job, was living and working in a residential drug rehabilitation centre, which I did for 3 years in my early 20s. And I learned a huge amount in those 3 years, both about the intensely personal work of rehabilitation and recovery, and about the roles of relationships of different sorts in those processes, and about the power, for better and for worse, of the social contexts of people's attempts to rebuild and reclaim their lives. So I guess you could say that my first tutors in rehabilitation were experts by experience. It was, you know, by living alongside that attempt to travel the journey of rehabilitation and beyond it, return and reintegration, that I kind of refined and developed my interest. I subsequently trained as a social worker, and coming out of that training, and initially as a social worker, I think I was a fully and naively committed rehabilitationist, in the sense that my training had not equipped me with a sufficiently critical analysis of rehabilitation's problems, of its contradictions, of its limitations. And it was only through painful practice experience that I discovered that I was doing a lot of harm in the name of doing good. And obviously, as I returned to research and to the academic world, I was able to make sense of that through the research of other people, many other people, and also through my own research over the last 20, almost 30 years, in fact. as my research career has developed, and particularly in the last 10 or 15 years, using creative practices as part of research, knowledge exchange and community building, I have spent more and more time in community with people after prison. And some of the people I spend most of my time with, more of my time with than anyone else now, are friends that I've made through those networks, friends who have lived experience. And that, those friendships, the things we've learned together in those contexts and those communities have made me much more critical about contemporary rehabilitation, especially in its risk-obsessed forms. And I've often been challenged directly and indirectly by critical criminologists like Miranda, and by their work to let go of rehabilitation as a defunct or a defective penal imaginary, to use Pat Carlin's framing, which I discussed last time. But I'm stubborn, so I cling on to rehabilitation, I think because I know that in some form, or with a particular meaning, it's still highly significant to lots of people caught up in criminal justice systems. So that's what many of those people tell me. And secondly, because I genuinely believe that rehabilitation is a universal human need. I think every person, every family, every community, every society has to find a way of responding to harms and wrongs, a way that allows for the repair of social relationships. So even if you're a complete abolitionist, and even if you hate the word rehabilitation because of what it stands for, you have to come up with something, which I think I could argue would be a form of rehabilitation, albeit one which is probably differently ordered, differently structured, differently controlled, differently mediated. So if I'm not going to give up on the idea without a struggle, the alternative is to use this project to try to clarify what rehabilitation is, what it means, whether and how it should be imagined or reimagined, and also to kind of use this 5 years to confront the other possible conclusion, which is that it is, to use an English phrase, a busted flush. It's a kind of a pipe dream that doesn't deserve to survive, and that rather the challenge is to replace it or to do something more radical and more different. So I think choosing these three sites of comparison is intended to give rehabilitation every chance to redeem itself, if I can put it that way. But the question is open and has to be genuinely open at this stage. So part of, in coming in conclusion to my hopes for the project and to narrow specifically on to Scotland, well, my hope is that we help to clarify these questions and that we arrive at evidence-based and provocative conclusions about what should be done in this space. That's particularly important for Scotland because I think Scotland is a very contradictory and paradoxical place when it comes to rehabilitation and punishment more generally. For more than 100 years, almost 130 years, Scotland has been pursuing a policy of decarceration and rehabilitation in theory or in rhetoric. It comes in different forms, it comes and goes. It is sometimes overwhelmed by other forces, but there's a very consistent thread through the history of punishment and rehabilitation in Scotland. But I think, and I think many other critical criminologists think, that that has become a self-serving, self-satisfied rhetoric, part of our national myth-making, which we're very good at in Scotland. That's the bleak reading. The other reading is that it persists because there's something important about it that speaks to values and traditions that could be mobilised to make rehabilitation more real and to use it to support inclusive aspirations and even aspirations that can do something to push back against everything from democratic backsliding to the rise of authoritarianism and the kinds of cruelty being visited upon all sorts of marginalised populations at the moment. So actually, politically, the stakes are obviously very high. A final point, and this actually speaks to something that Rob said, my other hope for Scotland is that the project helps to deal with Scotland's isolation post-Brexit. Scotland didn't vote for Brexit. I think we were 2-1 in favour of remaining in the European Union. But Brexit's consequences nonetheless affect us greatly in every way imaginable. And Scottish, the world of Scottish criminal justice is not well connected with European developments, in spite of the fact that the governing party in Scotland considers itself to be very pro-Europe and very European and cosmopolitan in outlook. So trying to help build bridges for people of all sorts in this project, the policymakers, the practitioners, the experts by experience, to help them build relationships with similarly situated people with common interests in Norway and the Netherlands is probably as important a legacy of this project as all the more formal academic things that we intend to do. So those are some of my hopes and some of my reasons for getting the whole thing up and running. But as everybody's been saying, we're only 6 months in, so there's a long, long way to go. Back to you, Rob.
Fergus, thank you so much. And thank you and Miranda for keeping to time so conscientiously, because I wouldn't want our discussion time to be squeezed. I'm just going to give myself permission as chair to say just one thing, and that is, in his introduction, Thomas mentioned the late Niels Christie, and I can just think that he would have loved this project and the way in which you talk about it. I remember reading in his book how he had used to get together these seminars, did he not? And sit down with people who were policymakers and practitioners and scholars and people who were on the sharp end, if I can put it that way, of criminal justice, recognizing that that pooling of wisdom was bound to be very, very fruitful. So I think he would have loved this project. And for me, that's a high commendation. So, right, please come up with your, please raise your electronic hands or put things in the comments or wave or shout, or, because we now need to have a conversation. And Fergus, Miranda and Thomas have said some wonderful, stimulating things. So please go for it. Well, if you won't, I will. Do you really think you did a lot of harm, Fergus?
I think I did harm and good. What I was referring to primarily, actually, in that comment was about net widening and up tariffing, to use technical jargon. So as a young social worker who was so enthusiastic about the possibilities of rehabilitation and social inclusion, I was pretty careless about the things that I recommended to courts. And I drew people into the net of supervision carelessly at the beginning of my career, and it took some pretty sobering and adverse outcomes for some of those people to sober me up in that regard. And I think within a couple of years I had learned to be much more careful in the way that I was targeting the use of probation and other kinds of community sanctions specifically. And also I think I probably learned a lot from the drug rehab about the way in which power and control and systems of rules can be managed with more or less humanity in the way that practitioners exercise discretion. But also, you know, I sort of speaks to Miranda's academic interest, but I was also kind of acutely aware of the ways in which that discretion could produce injustice and bias and unevenness and outcomes for people for unjustifiable reasons. So I think even if my social work training had not prepared me well for some of those, for addressing or preventing some of those risks, it did teach me to be critically reflective and to gather evidence and evaluate reflectively what I was doing. And so it gave me the tools to figure out the things that I was doing wrong, and that worked pretty quickly to change the way that I imagined my role, my work and my practice.
Thank you, Fergus. I can personally identify with a lot of what you've just said. My position being rather similar. Tracy, you've raised your hand, so please make your comment or ask your question.
Yeah, thank you. My name is Tracy McFall. I'm Chief Executive of Scottish Recovery Consortium, worked across justice, mental health, addictions for 30 years. Probably just a couple of things. There's something, there's a piece of work happening in the university right now around the social perceptions, around reframing the social perceptions around social care, because in social care, the problem becomes so big, Fergus and others, that it becomes so big it can't be solved. So I just wonder if there's anything around this work that's looking at how in societies we can start to reframe the narrative around your justice system. So there's an observation there for me, but there's also, and I think we do need to reframe it, because actually it becomes so big, even politicians don't know how to deal with it. Even politicians don't know how to fix it because it becomes so big. And there's something around, what I'm really interested in is that gender-based lens around that rehabilitation space, because women have different complexities, women need different things from men. So it's probably just, you maybe don't have the answers because it's quite big, but I suppose just in the context of this work, is there anything that you can probably share with the group in relation to those two bits, the reframing and obviously the context around rehabilitation for women, which is different for men?
Yeah, I can certainly, well, I'll tackle the first of those things, because that's actually on my agenda for a different reason at the moment. So it's interesting, isn't it, when you address what seem to be intractably complicated social problems, the person engaging with the problem tends to think of a solution that corresponds to the type of skill or role or activity that they have. So they, you know, the social worker, this was me actually, career-wise, the social worker looked for a way to change social work, and the prison governor looks for a way to change prisons, and so on and so forth. But of course, the nature of these problems is that they can't really be addressed through localised interventions that tinker with specific aspects of systems if they don't engage with systems thinking as a whole, and also beyond that, with more imaginative and creative solutions that actually reframe the problem rather than just looking for alternative solutions. And actually, academic work at its best reframes problems, even if it doesn't always provide the answers that people are looking for. And that's one of the reasons why we built creative practices into the project, because creative practices also, I think, have the capacity, and this has been my experience lately, have the capacity to reframe both the way that we make sense of what the problems are and the imagining of different responses. So I think, yeah, using creative practices in this project is intended to kind of unlock some of that intractability and to think in a different way. The dialogical approach is also intended to get people into conversation with other forms of knowledge, other forms of expertise, other forms of experience, in the hope that that can have a similarly unlocking effect. I'll say less about the second point about gender, but only to say that we're, although it's a big project and runs for 5 years, the way that we've constructed the part when we reach into people's experiences using the ethnographic and creative methods, we still can't reach a huge number of people. So we're not going to be able to do something that is statistically generalizable. What we're going to try to do is engage as much diversity as we can at that point, so that we're involving people who are differently situated in relation to the questions and concerns that we're trying to explore. And so for sure, we will ensure that women are well represented in those conversations, and not just women who are on the receiving end of rehabilitation, but also we'll think about gender in relation to lived experience, gender in relation to policy making, gender in relation to practice, and see what that kind of attentiveness can unlock in the conversation too. I don't know if Miranda wants to chip in as well on that.
Yeah, maybe a little bit on this question.
Miranda, we're having trouble hearing you.
Of course.
I think your internet was just a bit slow, and then it's caught up with you just when Rob mentioned that. But try again now. It might work now.
Try again, yes.
Maybe a short reflection on the first question. Yeah. Is that understandable now? Because I was referring to it already a little bit in my introduction, the societal, the effect of societal narratives on decision making and the way that the society is looking now at soft skills and things like social care, for example. Yeah, I really think that they are doing better on that aspect in Norway compared to the Netherlands and Scotland, as I know from our earlier research on normalization. So, yeah, at this moment, I really hope that we will be able to learn from the Norwegian experiences. The extent to which we also will involve women, female experiences in our project, I actually have the same answer as Fergus. And that's also one of the complicated parts of the project, I think. On the one hand, we want to, it's big and we want to draw general conclusions. On the other hand, most of our research will be very qualitative and contextualized. So if we can really, what groups we will really include in our empirical work, we simply have to decide on that in a later stage. But I know from Ulla, from our PhD, that already in the application stage, she really very much expressed that she would like to involve this group. So that's a good idea.
Miranda, thank you very much. I saw that Dave Ward had his hand up earlier, but I don't know if I can't see that hand any longer. But before we turn, perhaps Dave, you'll excuse me anyway, because some interesting things are popping up in the comments and the chat. And Colin Back is using the network in the way networks should be used to do some networking. And so if anyone wants to follow Colin's suggestion, Colin's keen to engage with people out from other countries who've worked on reducing recalls and out-of-court resolutions for people who have formerly served in the military services. I don't know if you want to say more about that, Colin, or whether it would be okay just for that to sit in the comments and for people to look at that if they want to come back to Colin. Meanwhile, maybe I can turn to the question that Shona has posed, a question for Miranda and maybe Fergus too. Miranda, you mentioned cultural differences when looking at differences between practice and outcomes. Can you say a bit more about how you intend to go about that? And is it you're thinking about that from the outset, or do you just anticipate that it'll become more relevant when you begin to make these comparisons between the three nations involved?
Yes, I think the thing with cultural influences is that you are not really aware of them as long as you only look from your own perspective. But of course, we don't start from scratch, and we know already quite some things about cultural differences between these three countries from earlier research. For example, for the Netherlands, I think the focus really shifted to managerialism, responsabilization in the last two, three decades. That's really different from the time in which, for example, David Downes wrote his comparative study. But I think it will in particular be in comparison with each other that we will be even more aware of those cultural influences and the impacts they have on decision-making in the criminal justice system and with regard to rehabilitation and reintegration. So, that's where I have the highest expectations from.
There's a little bit of work that we're doing already in Work Package 1, which is kind of digging into cultural sources for the development of the rehabilitative ideal in each country and trying to understand a bit about how our kind of different cultures might have shaped that ideal in different ways. So, for example, Thomas is kind of looking at Norwegian literature and novels and the way in which the stories of prisoners and their lives during and after prison are told and what that reveals about, I guess, I'm speculating, I don't know yet, but about Norwegian welfarism. There's that work he referred to from Pratt and others, some of which kind of references the Lutheranism of Norway and the kind of lower social distances between people as shaping approaches to punishment and reintegration in interesting ways. By contrast, I've always wondered whether Scotland's Calvinism creates a cleft between a condemnatory response versus a wrapping back in response, a kind of a contradictory pressures at the same time within the sort of Scottish cultural milieu broadly conceived. So we're looking at that. We're looking at Scottish fairy tales or folk tales. That's the fun project for the summer for me. So we're doing different things to try and surface cultural influences. But they're also bound to emerge as we go. And one kind of fundamental reason why they matter is that I think they find a reflection in systems which we've already noticed are different in the extent to which they dehabilitate. I think I mentioned this last time. But if you think about it, when we talk about rehabilitation, we're often trapped by the idea of correctionalism. If you set that aside for a moment, think about the fact that when you push somebody away to an institutional context in particular, you create dehabilitation and you have to then rehabilitate to bring people back. But the three countries in question here do that to different degrees. And to pick up on Thomas's point about recidivism rates in Norway, maybe they're lower because they push people away less than we do in Scotland, so that the return is not as great a distance to travel as it is for the Scottish returning prisoner, for example. So why then are different countries pushing people away to different degrees for different durations with different consequences in different orders and structures? And I think part of the answer to that have to be deeply cultural. But it's too soon to be more confident than that about the answer.
Okay, thank you. Can I turn to some other questions that are sitting in the comments, in the chat? Annabelle, from an English point of view, is asking what do we think England and Wales can learn from other countries? At the moment, as many of us know, rehabilitation can, it's not an auspicious climate in England. There's this strong emphasis on managerial styles, on punishment. Meanwhile, politicians are failing to make the changes that we know are highly significant to crime and to resistance around housing and poverty and so on. So this massive question, Annabelle, this is what the project's for. This is what they're going to try to find out about what we learn from other countries. But at this stage, Fergus, Miranda, what can we learn? What can it, should England learn from other countries? And indeed, the rest of the world, as somebody has rightly pointed out.
Yeah. You want to go first, Miranda?
Maybe a little bit more about our choice to focus on what we call progressive countries. I mean, on the one hand, I am sometimes doubting if the Netherlands can still be considered a progressive country. And maybe you have the same doubts about Scotland now and then. And indeed, we don't have results yet, of course, but the outcomes very much will be the result of the choices we have made now, and that is including those three countries. But the other part of that choice is in how far other countries that have a totally different, that have to apply rehabilitation in a totally different context, can learn from the experiences of these three progressive countries. And then I'm not so much talking about England and Wales, but we, for example, just visited Indonesia for the World Conference on Probation a few weeks ago or so. And then, you see that resources are almost not available for probation. You see there's a huge overpopulation in prison. You see that there's a workload of probation officers of 200 clients per person or so. And then, yeah, we also have to translate the results of the study to our three countries to these kind of totally different contexts. So that's still a question for me too. But I think we have to be very much aware of that choice.
I'm going to answer this question in a very strange way, because I got two episodes into Dear England, the Gareth Southgate docu-series, or whatever you call it. And the thing that was, this is, for those of you who haven't seen it, this is about the England manager, former England manager's attempt to kind of revive the fortunes of the England football team over the course of the last few tournaments. And it's very interesting to watch because he clearly approached that as a problem of culture, a problem of narrative, a problem of identity, and a problem of values, rather than a problem of tactics or strategies or technique even. And although the metaphor is a bit stretched, what interests me is that if I was trying to fix, to use a hideously simplistic expression, if I was trying to fix English probation or English prisons, actually I would start with those kinds of questions rather than with the kind of technicalities and the tactics and the strategies. I think the challenge to people in any jurisdiction is, what do you want your system to stand for? What do you want it to represent? The normative questions matter hugely. And maybe one of the things the project can do is to confront those normative questions, not just for the three countries in question, but for other countries by extension. And to pick up on the point about, you know, why not further afield? Absolutely, we have much to learn from other countries and other world regions. And we're very keen, as I keep saying every time I present on this, to open source the methodology and say to anybody anywhere, if you want to do something similar, take the frameworks if you think they might work, or if you think they need to be adapted or you know, totally changed for a different context, we'd still love to talk to you and be part of a conversation about how that could extend the comparison and improve the learning. So we're very open to that, but obviously We had to make a case for specific funding to do specific things, and we had our reasons for picking these countries in the first place.
Fergus, thank you. Before there are a couple more good comments in the chat, but I wonder if I could ask, and I'm terribly sorry, I'm not quite sure what your name is, but you're appearing on my screen as MG Morris.
Yeah, hello. Sorry, I couldn't change my name anymore. I'm Alina.
No, please don't worry about it, but please introduce yourself and make your point.
Yeah, thank you so much for the presentation and all the comments that have been made. It's very interesting. I'm Melina Malgers. I'm a PhD candidate from Tilburg University in the Netherlands, and I research rehabilitation within international criminal law. And I'm currently in Rwanda doing research there. So I was very struck by the comment Professor McNeil made about rehabilitation as a human need. And you explained it as a need because society looks at a way of responding to wrongs. And this is also what I strongly see in the culture here in Rwanda. But I was wondering, could you maybe elaborate a bit more on how you see it? Why do you frame rehabilitation as a need?
Okay. So without getting too religious or theological, because that's not my training, but it seems obvious to me that human beings will always fail and will always cause harm and suffering to one another. It seems like an inevitable part of the human condition that we at times will fail to live up even to the values that we express and espouse and that we would wish to adhere to. So human frailty ultimately means that unless we're prepared to let relationships go when people harm each other and just say that's the end of the relationship, then we have to find a mechanism of repair. And in many parts of the world, that will be nothing to do with the state. And in relation to many kinds of wrong and many kinds of interpersonal harm, that will be nothing to do with the state. It so happens that some wrongs and some harms are criminalized. And then, particularly in Western countries and in the global north, the state then makes it the state's business to oversee that process. And that's not the only way of dealing even with criminalizable harms and wrongs. And we know that from parts of the world where the state is weak or non-existent, and where instead communities find their own mechanisms for restoration, repair, but also sometimes for retribution. And, you know, I don't want to kind of romanticise what community justice looks like in different places. Miranda and I are working with others on a different project, which is trying to decolonise the way that we think about community justice and engage with scholars and others globally to think about what we in the West and North would tend to term probation, but to think about it in a much more open way, which doesn't require a particular set of institutions or a particular infrastructure or even a specific legal mechanism, but rather a way of responding to harms and wrongs that happens within communities, not within institutions. So, yeah, I think rehabilitation can, to me then, can refer to any way that we try to negotiate that reconciliation or return when harms and wrongs have breached human relations. And when that has threatened, particularly when that has threatened harmony and well-being or order within a community or within a state. So, you know, there are obviously lots of different levels of seriousness that we could think about in that regard, lots of different forms of harm and wrong, from the relatively minor to the incredibly serious. But the same sort of fundamental question, are you going to put it in really crude terms, are you going to kill this person? Are you going to banish this person? Are you going to mutilate this person? Or are you going to incapacitate this person within a prison setting? Or are you going to do something that allows for some means through which people will live together again in the future? And if the answer to the last question is yes, there's a form of rehabilitation taking place. But it might or it might not look anything like what we think of as rehabilitation in the three countries in this project or in the global north and west. So, yeah, when I say it's a universal human need, that's obviously a very bold and very broad claim. But at its fundamental level, it's just the observation that we fail, we harm each other, and unless we're going to remove ourselves from relationship, then we have to have some mechanism of relational repair. I call that rehabilitation, but others would have other names for it.
Well, among the other names they might have for it would be restorative justice. But that's in a whole new pathway, isn't it? But I think one of the strengths of your broadening the concept of rehabilitation focus, as you've done so many times, is to remind us that the changes that need to be made are not just on one side. There could be a number of changes that need to be made. That's a comment rather than a question, if you'll forgive me. Simon, you've raised in the chat something really interesting that I don't want to lose, but I'm going to ask you to forgive me if I turn next to Maria Raventos. And can I ask you to turn on your camera and microphone and speak to us, please?
Hello, can you hear me well?
Yes.
Perfect. So I want to a little presentation, if you may. If I'm able to do it, because my name is Maria and I'm preparing my proposal to do a PhD next year about rehabilitation in sexual offenders in Ireland. So I'm wondering if in that project you take into account the type of crime that person commit, because what comes to my mind is that the possible difference in rehabilitation process between the sexual offenders of another type of crime, because at least in a social level, there is a difference in the punishment that the people do to the between depends on the type of the crime. So that's my question. Thank you very much.
Miranda.
So but Miranda, I'd yeah, Miranda.
To answer that.
No, I think, of course, when we're looking at cases, the crime that is committed is a very important part of the rehabilitation process and will make a difference. And I think also in the more quantitative part of the project, we will probably differentiate between rehabilitation processes and activities related to different type of crimes. But as such, do we... So it can't be neglected, I think, that it makes a difference, but not so much in a categorical sense, I think, much more on an individual level and on the relation between the people who committed an offense and society, or the person who committed an offense and the victim. It makes a difference. I think it's that kind of processes that we try to expose in our project, and not so much try to say something about differences between categories of offenses, because I think, yeah, maybe in a quantitative sense there are those kind of differences, but not so much in the more in the rehabilitation process that we actually try to research.
I would just add very briefly that if you think about the six forms model and you think about people who have been convicted of sexual offences, then it seems pretty obvious that in many contexts in the social rehabilitation domain, the degree of stigmatisation is going to have important effects on rehabilitative and reintegrative prospects. And also legal requalification or legal rehabilitation is also problematic or complicated by, in many countries, for example, notification and registration schemes and what that means for civic status and participation in civic life, and the requirements of disclosure and so on and so forth. So I think there are differences, and we have to use our kind of stratified sampling, to use the technical term, or attempts to generate diversity within the people that we engage to cover as much as we can. But I agree with Miranda. I think the differences there are individual differences that might make require us to attend to important differences in the relevance of different aspects of rehabilitation. But I don't know if they fundamentally change the way that I would think about the six forms model, for example. I think the model is can accommodate that kind of diversity within it, albeit that it would insist that we then think about which domains are going to raise which specific challenges for which particular population. So, yeah.
Right. Can I turn then, thank you for those answers, both of you, and thank you for the question, which was a very useful one. Go back to the question that Simon has posed in the chat. I don't know if Fergus and Miranda and others have had a chance. This is a deep and searching question, I think. Simon is asking about how we often have these separate discussions about research and risk and modernization. But if what we do now is not really working very well, then hanging on to what we do now is in itself inherently risky, maybe more risky than making certain kinds of change. So how can we bring all that together? How can we integrate research with implementation, taking into account that some of the policies that are, when they come to be implemented, the world tells us that the criminal justice system is particularly good at shooting itself in the foot. It doesn't often, it manages to achieve the exact opposite of what it set out to achieve. So what do you have to, it's a huge question, and I don't expect you'll be able to answer it definitively until you write your next books, Miranda and Fergus, but nevertheless, if you like a quick go at that, it would be interesting to hear.
I would just say quickly that, you know, one way that we would hope to address some of these difficulties is through the dialogical approach that we're articulating. So we're not going into the project assuming or pretending or claiming that research has answers, or even that we will produce answers that can then be implemented. It's not that linear. Rather, by engaging with these different forms of knowledge and by bringing them into conversation with one another, critical conversation, challenging conversation, international conversation, we are creating the possibility that different actors in the project, different participants in the project, are challenged in different ways, not just to reach for different solutions, but to reframe the problem in different ways. So it's a more fundamental aspiration, actually, than the challenge of translation or the challenge of knowledge exchange or dissemination, because we're not proceeding from the assumption that we make a discovery and it's the job of others to implement that discovery in practice. Rather, it's a co-creation of discovery where there'll be at least as much challenge coming our way from our participants, whether they're correctional leaders or people with lived experience or frontline practitioners. They'll be challenging us as much all the way through our engagement. So that's the aspiration anyway. And that's also the way that we're setting up our advisory group, to kind of be there from the outset, in order to kind of be part of this critical conversation, shaping not just the way that we do the research, but the way that we relate to one another through the project.
And if I've understood Simon's question properly, I think he sort of recognises that recognises what you've just said, Fergus, and that just as you're co-creating in the course of your project, there's going to need to be co-creation between policymakers, practitioners, and research scholars to come up with ways forward.
Yeah, I agree. But again, it's not that the operational reality should trump the need for a reimagining, nor is it that the reimagining should compel a particular form of implementation. It's more of ideally, or maybe even idealistically, it's more that the dialogue allows everybody, actually we use this expression I think at times, everybody gets to oscillate between proximity to the problem, like being in the field, struggling with those realities, and then taking critical distance and analysing reflectively, creatively, imaginatively, and then everybody's back in the field, and then everybody's back out. So if people move with us from, to use a terrible cliche, from the ivory tower to the mucky field and back, if we're oscillating together between those two positions, then the things that you can see from those two different perspectives are available to everybody through dialogue, and that generates the possibility, hopefully, of more transformative solutions.
Beautifully put, Fergus. Thank you so much. I hope, Simon, that you feel that justice has been done to your very deep and searching question. Time is
maybe
not
Simon
on
maybe Simon wants to respond to her.
Yeah, sorry, Miranda, please.
Maybe Simon wants to respond.
Oh,
to
yeah.
This,
well, Simon, is up, it's up to you. Simon posted in the chat. If you want to take this. Yes, there's Simon. Simon, do please come in if you wish.
Yeah, I guess, you know, I worked in the Canadian system for 7 years or so, and then moved into the private sector for the last little while. And the one thing that I always struggle, and maybe modernization isn't the right word, maybe it's evolution's a better word. But one of the things I always struggled with was that, one, I don't think correctional organizations make the space to actually think differently. I have a colleague in California who says that corrections is often trying to reinvent the flat tire. And I think that there's something spot on about that. But so what happens in correctional jurisdictions is that a lot of times there's thinking or oversight or litigation that drives evolution. And I don't know if they necessarily take ownership of that evolution. It's almost inflicted upon them. And I wonder sometimes if research then kind of falls into that as well, is that it's like starting to point out where things need to be perhaps different. And how can the relationship between researchers and jurisdictions start to evolve, because I don't think it's productive for the jurisdiction because they end up having all the accountability, right? Because the status quo is actually often inherited. So there's a tendency to not acknowledge that risk nearly as much. And the new thing becomes very risky. And so how can the relationship start to evolve and change between the jurisdictions and the work that you folks are doing so that we're actually getting and we're moving towards better outcomes and enabling the jurisdictions to move forward, if that makes sense?
Yeah, and could you think that the dialogical comparative methods that we are now proposing could or would have made a difference to you, for example, when you were still in practice? Because I agree with Fergus, that's exactly the new element of our study that hopefully also can be probably structurally embedded in decision-making processes in the jurisdictions in the countries after we finished this project. So different participants can continue to learn from each other.
It's a good question, because there's learning and then there's action. And what I wonder is, like, you know, there can be great conversations and great thinking, but how do you actually translate that into action? And then I guess that's where I struggle a little bit.
So I think that is a great, almost, I think Rob is edging towards encouraging us to end. So I think there's a full circle here to the first question, actually, which was about framings. Because whenever we get into this conversation about the possibilities of radical or transformative change within systems, the kind of criminology of the reimagining of rehabilitation starts to butt up hard against the sociology of punishment. So what we learn from punishment and society scholarship about why these systems are so rarely evidence-based or why they're driven by different dynamics, different pressures, different political, social, and cultural and economic forces that shape the way that corrections are. When you were talking about the flat tire, I started off thinking about a car, and then I thought, no, it's a bicycle, and then I thought, no, it's a monocycle. It's like it's the flat tire on a monocycle is the extension of that lovely metaphor. But breaking out of that isn't something that will be achieved through the development of better evidence-based approaches, because it fundamentally requires an engagement with questions which are political and which are normative and which do require public dialogue and public engagement that changes the dial on what's possible for administrators and for politicians and for others with a measure of influence to imagine and to do. So I think, again, that's why at the end of this project the reframing stuff that we started the conversation with today will surface again. Some of the creative work that we do will go into public exhibitions in each of the countries. Some of the people will travel across the jurisdictions and hopefully have the opportunity to engage with public dialogue about these questions. Now, I know from past experience that's really hard to do, and it's really hard to make it make a powerful impact, particularly when you're running against the current of the times or other kind of overwhelming social and political pressures. But if the alternative is doing nothing, then I'm not up for that either. So we'll try.
Simon, I need to cut things off. As Fergus is saying, he's quite right. I am trying to edge towards a conclusion because we've made promises to people that we'll end punctually. I'd just like to thank you, Simon, for the provoking such a fascinating discussion as that. Fergus, I'm going to ask you and or Miranda to say a few final words. And those words, final words, include this. What about a return to a forum like this perhaps in a year's time, so you can tell us how you've been getting on?
I'll defer to Miranda, but I'm up for doing that. So, Well, final words to Miranda.
The INCJ people might well want you to well put that invitation to you too and to Thomas. But do you
absolutely, and it will probably also involve our young researchers.
Wonderful, and maybe some service users as well to tell us how it's been for them, because they are part of this too, very much. Any final words, Fergus, Miranda?
I think you've had more than enough words from me over two webinars, so I'll shut up at this point.
I'm just going to say one thing, and I hope you'll forgive me for this, because it's introducing a brand new theme at precisely the wrong time, but it's something that's quite close to my heart at the moment because of a personal friendship. Whatever form of rehabilitation we're talking about, all the 4, 5, 6 or whatever they are at the moment, they're different for people who have committed crimes in countries other than their own and are confronting the risk of being moved from one country to another. And I hope I'm sure that's a dimension that won't get lost, but it very often does. And this seems to me to be a compelling problem for so many countries, and one that's being universally dealt with really, really badly. So if in the course of the project you could find ways of dealing with that, I personally would be thrilled.
Yeah. Thank you, Rob, for reminding us. I think this is indeed a very important group that we shouldn't forget.
Okay. There's lots of nice things coming into the chat, so I think it's only now for me to close the meeting to thank particularly Fergus and Miranda, but to thank everybody. There are people here who had questions to ask and weren't able to ask them, so thank you for your forbearance. And some of the questions that were asked were terrifically good and provoked some fascinating discussion. So may I thank Fergus, Miranda and Thomas on everyone's behalf, and wish you well with this fabulous project, and look forward to hearing more about it in the fullness of time. But our meeting has now come to an end, so I'll ask Rob to close it.
You have been listening to the INCJ podcast, conversations about international criminal justice. To find out more, go to our website at criminaljusticenetwork.net or follow us on Twitter at INTCJ Network.